In the fabled land of Northern California, nestled in the Valley of Sacramento, two friends begin a journey to enlighten the world about their experience living life as a Xenial. But what is a Xenial, you may ask? If you wish to know, then follow them on their adventures.
Welcome to the Xenial Chronicles. This is James.
This is Mike.
A little bit of delay there, sir. And talking to each other via computers in our own separate homes, which will be happening, I'm sure, for a long time.
Yeah,
yes,
probably
I'm
a while.
Keep saying it because it's amusing. It's still been an interesting. Well, I think the first thing we wanted to talk about this week. It's been an interesting week in the sense that we've had some high profile celebrity deaths.
Yeah, we have. Yeah.
Some pretty big ones. I think first and foremost, we'll start with the one that that you felt the need to make a Facebook post about. This is the Double Rainbow guy.
Yeah, right? Yeah. He went by Yosemite Bear, was like his online handle.
Okay.
I can't remember his actual name. I did a Facebook post about it. But yeah, this is the guy that like made the viral Double Rainbow YouTube video in like 2010. And he got like crazy, crazy, like huge, huge, huge. Like it was like obviously this very tongue-in-cheek kind of like making fun of the dude for being freaked out at a double rainbow. But the guy actually worked. I think he was like a volunteer firefighter and stuff for a while.
Cool.
Yeah. He was pretty legit. He did a lot of traveling. I looked up some of the stuff on him. He was kind of like a wilderness hippie, you know, like just kind of, you know, peace, love, and hiking kind of a deal.
Yeah. That would explain why he was so psyched to see the Double Rainbow. I remember when the video first came out and hit big and everybody was, you know, it was on the news. It was being shared so much.
I know.
It was a big deal. And then different remixes of the, using like, the voice control stuff of him saying it.
The auto-tune stuff? Yeah.
Yeah, the auto-tune stuff, yeah. But I never knew who the guy was. I just knew the video existed, and it was like, that's kind of funny. It's what happens on the internet. Sometimes you're lucky, and you put something on YouTube, and you get thousands, if not millions of people, you know, watching it and paying attention to it, and sometimes you get like 30. You know, it just depends, I guess. I'm not bitter. It's kind of neat to have a moment of personal epiphany like that, noticing the beauty in nature and in life.
Yeah.
And while you may have been, poked fun at a little bit for it, it still is a lasting thing in kind of the world of viral videos.
Oh, yeah, that guy was world famous for a short period of time. That says a lot, man.
Enough that you make the news when you die in the same week that Little Richard and Jerry Stiller die.
Dude, right?
I mean, with two people of that caliber dying and then you die in the same week, you make the news for that. That means, if it's a slow news week, fine. But for a busy news week with celebrity deaths, for him to be put up in there with it, that's pretty hefty.
I will tell you that I did not expect him to get an article like that. I did not expect him to be the, you know, I consider him to be part of the rule of three at this point, which is...
He may or may not be. There was another rock singer that died, but I do not remember... He was a singer for a short time in a couple of different bands.
Oh, really?
But I don't remember who he was.
Oh my goodness. You know what? I think I know who you're talking about. I can't remember his name, but he was a singer for Bad Company for a while.
Yes. That's one of the bands that he sang in.
It's not Paul Rogers. Paul Rogers is still alive and well, but as far as I remember, anyway. I'm not.
You would know the singer of Bad Company better than me.
Yeah. Paul Rogers is the voice of Bad Company. He's the one everybody knows. He was in Bad Company and he was in Free and all that kind of stuff. But this guy, I can't remember his name. He was a guy that took over after Paul Rogers left and went on his own and that kind of thing.
So. Okay.
But it was quite some time back. Bad Company's one of those storied bands that has a lot of they're a revolving door like any other longtime super long time working band. They've got some level of a revolving door at some point, you know?
Yeah, you have some members that go through. You have mm-hmm. a Van Halen situation.
Van Halen, AC/DC did it. Metallica's even did it.
Technically, AC/DC's only had two main vocalists. They had one guy sit in for a concert tour.
They did, but now Malcolm's the youngest young brother is sitting in for Malcolm.
Okay, but I mean, I was thinking more singers than anything else.
No, I understand.
Yeah.
Hey, man, the band is not just the singer, sir.
Okay.
What?
No, you are very right in that in that estimate. Although
awkward silence.
Oftentimes, it's just the singer and maybe one other instrumentalist. I mean, honestly, can you tell me the name of anybody else in Bon Jovi other than John Bon Jovi and Richie Sambora?
Not fully, though. No.
Okay.
I wouldn't.
Yeah.
But I can tell. I'll tell you this. I can tell you who Duff McKagan is.
Well, yes, and again, there are some bands that do have that ability to make
KK
sure.
KK Downing, Steve Stevens.
Yeah, like I said, there's some bands that have that ability where you do end up knowing the name of every band member, or at least every original band member.
And then there's the session people, Tal Wilkenfeld. You got to look her up. She will blow your friggin' mind.
Wouldn't surprise me. Session guitarists. Didn't they do recently a like in 2015 or something, a huge documentary on like a huge group of session guitarists that have played for all different people and are some of the guitarists nobody ever knows but are some of the best guitarists around because they've done so much session work.
You know, I don't know right off the top of my head.
I think it was called Hired Guns.
Oh, I'm going to have to check that out. I haven't seen that.
Yeah.
One of my favorite documentaries is, do you ever look up the Muscle Shoals documentary?
No. I don't think so.
So there's a line in a Lynyrd Skynyrd song in Sweet Home Alabama. And the line is, a lot of people don't remember what the line exactly says.
Well, that's because when people listen to that song, they're usually drunk.
True, but this is completely beside the waypoint because these guys. Okay, so there was a band called the Swampers. Okay,
okay,
they were the backing band on some of the most soulful R&B music and some of the most soulful rock music to ever come out of the United States in the 50s and 60s. Yeah. In the 60s, yeah. Excuse me, in the 60s and 70s. Okay. Think about it. I know a really good track you're going to know right off the top of your head. Oh my God. I believe it's, I'm trying to think of the name. I think it's Ain't Never Loved a Man by Aretha Franklin.
Okay. I think I know which one you're talking about.
Yeah. You know, you're no good heartbreaker. You're a liar. You're a cheat.
Yeah.
That one. Okay. That is all a band of like white dudes. There wasn't a single black band member on that song in that studio at that time, and it was an ad lib jam that she wrote the lyrics to in the studio right there. And she was like, okay, yeah, this is they were trying to look for it. And one of the things, like, back in the day, a lot of people don't necessarily know this, studio session writing was worth its weight in gold a lot of the time. You had guys that had the capability of exploring key and writing and doing things like right out of the gate rather than having to write all the material on your own and then go into a studio. It was a huge, huge, huge thing. But guys...
Especially when you're considering most people only think about the musicians mm-hmm. when you see the band as a whole performing. So you have your rock bands performing, and that's the only time you really think about these 3 to 5 musicians typically came together and wrote this stuff together, recorded this stuff together, and play it together. You don't think about the actual music part of it, the instrumentation part of it,
yep.
when it's just a solo act. So when you have your Aretha Franklin, or you have... You have, hell, even modern pop stars, when they're doing, you don't think about who plays the music, who wrote the music part, who plays the music part, who does all of these other things. All that is really concentrated on is the singer doing whatever they're doing for the singing.
Yes.
I mean, understanding that that the lead singer from Four Non Blondes, which only had that one big hit in the 90s,
mm-hmm.
That either you loved or you were annoyed by. I loved it, still do. She's written a crap ton of pop songs, including one of Christina Aguilera's most popular songs. The beautiful one. You know what I'm talking about?
Not off the top of my head. No, I can't. I don't know why I can't think of it.
You don't know Christina Aguilera probably that well, which is good.
Not. What album is it on?
I think the song was called Beautiful.
Okay. Yeah. Yes, I know what you're talking about. Beautiful? Yeah, that's off. Okay. So the Stripped album is a really good album. And not a lot of people know that I like that album. That's a bitchin' album.
And I believe her name is Lisa Perry of Four Non Blondes.
Yeah. Four Non Blondes. I think I know where you might be going with this. Yes.
She wrote that song. She wrote a couple of songs for Pink.
I think she became one of her main songwriters, co-writers.
Yes, she is one of the main people that works with Pink on music.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the thing is you don't often see all the background players in these things. And those are just people that do the songwriting. Then you add in the people that actually play the music. One of the bigger albums of the 90s, one of the biggest albums kind of ever as far as sales go, Alanis Morissette's Jagged Little Pill. Do you know who played guitar and bass on, at least on the song, You Ought to Know? I think they played it for the whole album, actually. Guitar, bass, and drums on You Ought to Know. I think they may have been the guitar and bass on the whole album.
Yes, I do, actually. That is the One Hot Minute version of the Red Hot Chili Peppers.
Yes, it is.
Yes.
Yes, it is. So that would be who on guitar?
That'd be Dave Navarro on guitar, man. That's one of my favorite unsung albums, dude. No, not a lot of people.
And that'd be Flea on bass.
Yep.
And who was playing drums for that? In fact, who was Alanis Morissette's drummer for a long time?
I thought that was Chad Smith, wasn't it?
No.
Really? Who was the drums on that song? Or who was the drums for her?
I think he was. Wasn't Taylor Hawkins already playing drums for her on Jagged Little Pill? Or did that come in the next
Taylor Hawkins was her drummer? No shit.
Yeah, I believe Taylor Hawkins. Go watch the video for... the song from the City of Angels soundtrack, Uninvited.
Cool.
It shows live footage, and it's Taylor Hawkins playing the drums for
it. Oh, damn, I got to go look that up. That's great.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's...
It's like learning Shannon Larkin was playing drums for, like, Vanilla Ice and stuff.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, he was He was actually ready to just call it because it wasn't working, and that's when Sully Erna called him up.
That's really interesting to know.
Yeah.
That puts me in mind of another Shannon that sang backing vocals for a friend before he got his band got to hit it big. Shannon Hoon sang backing vocals on one of the bigger rock songs in the 90s.
Yeah, you're talking, oh my goodness, that's Shannon Hoon. Wasn't that Blind Melon?
Yes, he was the lead singer of Blind Melon.
Yeah. Oh, that was a tragic one, man.
Yes.
That was sad.
The question is, what song is he singing backing vocals on?
I don't know.
It's a trick question because it's actually two songs with the same name on two different albums.
Really? Okay.
He sings backing vocals on both versions of Don't Cry or Don't You Cry from Guns N' Roses on Use Your Illusion 1 and 2.
Really?
Yeah, that's the high vocals that are the backing vocals. And in fact, you can see him in one of the videos for it. I forget which one of the two it is, because they made two different videos, if I remember correctly. There's a point where Axl's on top of a building on like a helicopter pad singing, and uh-huh. Shannon Hoon is there with him.
Oh, that's cool. Oh, that's cool. Okay.
But those are the things that you get, is you get kind of those unsung things that happen. If I remember correctly, in fact, you can correct me if I'm wrong, because you probably know the history better than I do.
Mm-hmm.
Little Richard used to have a very interesting former military guy playing guitar for him.
Yes, correct. That is true. That is true. I know exactly what you're talking about.
That's another moment of where you have a musician that was just kind of in the background. He was the guitar player for probably one of the first really great true rock and roll acts in mm-hmm. Little Richard, and I mean a character and a half. In fact, he has an amazing role in one of my favorite kind of B movies, one of my old blockbuster B movies that I just love to death.
Oh, really?
Still to this day, I can watch it anytime. Oh, and I tell you, it'll probably get your gears turning.
Okay.
But he's got an amazing moment in that movie. But the fact that he had this guitarist that was just one of his guitarists, just guy playing guitar for him, just a background player, basically, who ended up becoming who, Mike? Who did that guitarist become?
Become? He already was Jimi Hendrix, my friend.
Yeah, but nobody knew it.
Not yet.
It's just kind of funny you have those moments.
What's crazy is they actually had a falling out. The two of them had a falling out while he was touring, and he ended up leaving. He quit mid-tour. He had a falling out. Yeah, they had a falling out over pay. There was pay issues going on with him.
Not surprising.
Stuff happens. Like, I'm not trying to cause any drama or anything like that. It's just something that I happen to know. So, real quick, going to this, taking us back out of that segue for a second, I got to tell you about these guys. I happened to look them up. No, not the movie. No, the So this Muscle Shoals. Have you ever heard of the Muscle Shoals sound? Do you know who Muscle Shoals sound is? Or have you ever heard of them? Have you ever heard of that terminology?
No.
Okay.
I will be honest and say no.
Okay. So they were on a load of hits, and I mentioned the Aretha Franklin one, but they actually started getting famous because of a little band that was very, very, very into that soulful sound, like with what Aretha was doing.
Yeah.
That really wanted...
How come I have a feeling this little band that you're talking about is going to end up being something that everybody knows?
Oh, very much. Very much. Okay, now, these guys are the session guys that played along with them. Okay?
Yeah.
Now, this little band was already earning a name for themselves, but one of the things that they were big, big, big on doing was giving credit where credit was due to, especially to black soul and blues cats in the 60s.
Yeah.
And these guys broke around 1964, 1965, around the same time as the Beatles. There were a little band called the Rolling Stones. And so back
never in... Never heard of those guys.
Yeah, they're all right. But back in 1969, after Aretha had come out with her song, they're like, we want those kick-ass black cats that played on that record. We want them on our stuff. So they go down to Muscle Shoals, Alabama, which is where this studio is located. And they're like, yeah, where are these guys? And they get the Swampers to come into the studio, and they're, you know, four or five, white hippie looking guys, white Southern hippies are like, okay, cool. Where's the band? They're like, no, we are the band. They're like, all right, whatever. All right, well, let's get in our places. And they cut a little song called Brown Sugar.
How come that tastes so good?
Huh?
How come that tastes so good?
Yeah. And then on top of that, they kept doing stuff. So they also did Brown Sugar. They did Wild Horses. Those two were recorded in the same sessions. But there's other ones by other... there's other stuff, too. Like, they did... let's see. I'll Take You There by the Staple Singers, 1972.
Okay.
Breakaway by Art Garfunkel, Kathmandu, Night Moves in Main Street by really? Bob Seger. Yep. Is It So by Cat Stevens? They were on Night Moves. It's the same band, Night Moves, Main Street, and Kathmandu in 1975 and 1976. Gotta Serve Somebody by Bob Dylan. Old Time Rock and Roll.
Oh, really?
Yes. And here's another one. I'm going to blow your freaking mind with this one. Same guys, same studio, same band. About 23 or 24 years later after Brown Sugar they cut a song in 1983. Oh my. However, not the same as I thought. I'm looking at the table right now on the Wikipedia website. They cut a version of a hit song by George Michael in 1983 called "Careless Whisper."
Yeah.
However, it is not the hit version, and it was released as a B-side on a UK special 12-inch and on the Japanese 12-inch. Definitely looking this up when
version.
when we get done with this. I gotta hear this.
The curiosity will be if the saxophone is on it or not. I mean, that would be the biggest change I could see.
Oh, dude, if it's something that's done with that organ, their keys player was a Rhodes and Wurlitzer master, absolute master, and these guys are still doing stuff. From last I heard, there was a whole documentary done on him, like how the band earned their reputation, and then they broke off from one studio. Yeah, it's pretty crazy. However, if you hear the term, now I said Muscle Shoals, Alabama. The song I'm talking about with Lynyrd Skynyrd is the song Sweet Home Alabama. The line is, "Now Muscle Shoals has got the Swampers, and they've been known to pick a song or two. Lord, they get me off so much. They pick me up when I'm feeling blue. How about you?" That's the actual line. Nobody remembers the first lines.
Nobody knows what it means. They probably think it's some kind of a drinking thing. Because that's, again, the only time people really listen to that song is they're white folks and they're drinking, and they drink so that they can listen to that song, not realize how god awful it is.
Well, so they can drink and they can piss on Neil Young, I guess, right?
Well, I think you have to be drunk to even appreciate that song. It's so god awful.
Dude.
And hey, don't get me wrong.
I work at a live venue. Okay? I don't work at a live venue right now, but I work at a live venue that requires.
I mean, if you worked at a live venue right now, it'd be kind of like, no, I can play whatever the fuck I want. Fear Factory again.
Right? But yeah,
we're playing some guar.
Yeah, dude, I would totally do that. I would absolutely do that.
Maggots. So, you were saying this is required music, especially when there's white people around.
Definitely, for sure. However, I do work at a venue that requires that the band takes an extra large tip in order to be able to play it. There's a few songs like that they actually write into the contract that you have to be paid. Like, I think one of them is. I've never heard Mustang Sally ever played at this venue because the contract for the venue that I work at requires a $100 cash tip in order to play it. And I've never heard it played, and I've heard people request it.
That's a good venue right there.
Right? The venue doesn't have to be paid any of that tip at all, by the way. They're not like we're taking a cut. No, you have to ask them for $100. Like, you give you $100, sure, they pay you $100. You play that all day long if you want, but you're not playing it unless you get paid $100.
Understand that.
I mean, that sounds like looking out for the bands, if you ask me.
That sounds like looking out for everybody.
Yeah.
I will say that there are some Skynyrd songs that I like. I like Simple Man, and I like Freebird in the right context.
Oh man, dude, Freebird is tough. Freebird is right tough context. For the vibe. It's you gotta have the vibe.
Well, no, I like it while I'm watching a British secret agent. Kill like 100 people in a church in the South. That's a movie reference. If you haven't seen the movie, go watch The Kingsman, because it's a great movie and it's an amazing sequence that just takes place basically over the solo of Freebird, and you'll never hear that song again in the same way we've discussed it before on here. You have your version of Freebird with Forrest Gump. I have mine, and mine's better. Because mine will put a smile on your face.
That was legit. Like, you did show me the scene after we did that podcast, and I was quite impressed.
Like Mike's version will depress you. Mine will just make you like, yeah, that was.
Oh,
good.
Dude, I don't know depression, man. That was just like that was some adrenaline stuff, man. That was like, is she gonna do it? Is she gonna do it? Is she gonna do it?
I guess it's kind of depressing, but anyway.
Hey man,
so there are songs that I do like of Lynyrd Skynyrd. I just freaking hate "Sweet Home Alabama."
Yeah,
and then like
it's just so overplayed, man.
Well, and then the demigod of trailer parks decided to since he'd already taken and stolen. Let me finish.
I know who you're talking about, and I love it.
A riff from Metallica and made it so that I would have to be careful listening to the radio because I hear the riff and I'm like, oh, cool, we're getting a Metallica song. It's great in concert, but I won't listen to it on a regular basis. But all right. And then his stupid, trashy ass has to start singing. I'm like, ah. Then he goes and tries to take. He takes a song that already sounds like Sweet Home Alabama, but it's not Sweet Home Alabama. But then tries to make it like Sweet Home Alabama. And it just really hurts your head.
Well, what's really funny about that is that he also took, you know, Werewolves of London as well and just smashed the two together. I remembered.
Yes, yeah, that's what I'm saying.
I remember hearing that song for the first time. I was pissed.
Yeah, because it's like you're thinking, okay, maybe it's Sweet Home Alabama. I can deal with that, but I'm not a fan. Maybe it's Werewolves of London. No, it's that ass. I'm going to say that I have good reason to be able to be angry with him, and let me explain why, sir. Let me explain why.
Okay.
In the summer of 2000, I was lucky enough, maybe it was fall, sometime summer into fall of 2000, I was lucky enough to go to what should have been an epic concert. It had five really good bands. I missed most of the first two bands, all of the first band, most of the second band, because we had a car that had a, we were driving there in a car that literally had a hole in its radiator, and we had to, it was in the Bay Area, so it was like a 4 or 5 hour drive, and we had to literally stop every hour and put water into it. It also had a gas cap with a key that the guy who I borrowed it from didn't give me the key to the gas cap, so we had to dismantle that to put gas in it. That was fun. That took about a half hour. So we were late getting to the show. And the show, now the beauty of the show was at Candlestick Park, the old Candlestick Park.
Oh man, that's
so
way back.
I actually got to walk on the field at Candlestick Park.
Oh, that's
and
cool.
And stand out on the field. Oh, it was a beautiful moment, sir. For a lifelong 49er fan, I'd been to Candlestick before to watch Giants games when the San Francisco Giants used to play there. Not because I like the Giants, because the Giants suck, but because I went to school in the East Bay and we got tickets. The school's got free tickets to take kids to baseball games. I'd go to the baseball game and with the school. It was field trips and stuff.
All right.
I don't know why it just worked out that way. That was before ticket prices got like super expensive. It was like $5 a ticket for a baseball game. So,
all right, I can get behind that.
And they do, what do they do? Like 150 baseball games each year for each team. So it's not like football where there's only 16 games in the season for your team. It's like 150 games. So like one game isn't going to be that important unless it's in the World Series or something. I got to be on the field, which is nice. So the bands that were playing, first band, the one we missed was Power Man 5000. Now, for anybody who doesn't know, I know Mike knows Power Man 5000.
Very much so.
He knows what it's like when worlds collide. Are you ready to go? Because I'm ready to go. That is the band that was fronted by.
Speaking of which, they are confirmed, as well as all the other original music, to be on the new. The remastered re-release of Tony Hawk's Pro Skater 1 and 2.
Nice.
Yeah, I'm gonna have to show you this footage if you haven't seen it yet. It's insanity.
You posted stuff, but I haven't watched it yet.
Oh my god. I'm gonna show it to you when we're done.
So anyway, we missed Power Man 5000, which they only had a couple of good songs, but still it would have been nice to see. And the closest that my wife was lucky enough, we were just dating at the time, but she was lucky enough to go to the show with me. And it would have been nice for her to at least see something close to Rob Zombie, who she's always been a huge fan of. That's probably one of her top five artists, period.
Rob Zombie's the shit. Rob Zombie is fantastic.
Rob Zombie is awesome. I didn't appreciate him as much back then. I used to make fun of him back then because, in fact, still to this day, there's a couple of his songs where I have my own lyrics for. And one of these days, we'll have to listen to it, and I'll have to give you my lyrics to a song.
Okay,
I
yeah, think totally.
You'll be amused.
Yeah.
But anyway, so we missed Power Man 5000. We missed, now, at this time, they had only had their first album out. So they only had like two songs that were big. They didn't have all the other albums yet, but still, I am sad that I only got to see one song as we were arriving and getting inside of Candlestick Park, System of a Down. Mm-hmm. This was back in their early days. So they had Sugar and they had Spiders, and that's like it, basically.
Oh, man.
Very, very sad that I missed even seeing them then.
Yeah. Because
now they're one of my favorite bands. I love them now. I love those two songs, and I love everything that came after it.
But right around that time, they were cutting demos for what would end up being Toxicity, though. Right? Yeah, so they had those, too.
Which they may have played at the show, and I may have missed.
Did you ever check out? Well, here's the thing. They had a ton of B-sides. There were tracks that never came out on that album that they were cutting that were dope as hell. Well, have you ever heard the album Steal This Album?
Yes, some of it.
Okay.
Not all of it.
Okay, so check this out. Steal This Album is called that because demos of the sessions for Toxicity that included demos from the songs that never made the first album's original cut were mashed together and thrown out and torn in on LimeWire way back in the day.
Yeah.
And what ended up happening was, so they came out with Toxicity. Somebody got a hold of all of the old session files and tapes and digitized them and threw them out on LimeWire, and they were pissed, but they couldn't do anything about it because it was already there. So they're like, well, hell, if all these songs that we decided not to put out are out, we might as well make money off of them. So they went back into the studio. They did a little bit of refined recording to make sure that they were done, and then they put them on an album and put that album out. But that album is one of my favorite albums, and those songs would have been played live before they were. You would have heard those songs before anybody else would have, they even came out. Again, that would have been dope.
Which, again, sucks. It was just one of those moments where that wasn't one of the bands we were going to see. It was just kind of a bonus to see that band.
Yeah, yeah.
So the next thing up was Kid Rock, which is one of the bands at least my wife was going to see because she was a huge Kid Rock fan.
What did you just call him a minute ago? Because I swear I might title the, depending on where this goes, I might title the episode that. What did you say, Demigod of Trailer Parks?
Demigod of the Trailer Park? Or the Trailer Park Demigod?
Yeah.
I like Trailer Park Demigod.
The Trailer Park Demigod? Okay.
And so she was going, his one big album had come out, so she was wanting to see Kid Rock because he was everywhere all over the radio. I mean, yes, the radio, the thing we had to listen to get music back in the day. And then after Kid Rock was Korn, which both her and I wanted to see.
Well, yeah.
And then, of course, you know what the headlining band was.
Of course. It was Summer Sanitarium.
Hell yes, it was Summer Sanitarium. It was awesome, and so we're geared up. We heard the last, at least the last song of System of a Down, and it was awesome from what we heard of it. I don't even remember which song it was, but whatever it was awesome as we were going in. And Kid Rock was setting up, and my wife was so happy we had arrived in time for Kid Rock. And then, and by the way, this is back when Josie was still alive. By the way, was still alive, and Josie was there.
Nice.
But what ends up happening is, as we're watching the show, Uncle Cracker, who is still part of his band at that point.
Oh, yeah.
And the lady who is the drummer are doing all of the singing. And Kid Rock is just running around the stage, flinging his hair around, being just a general white trash douchebag. But he only sang like 20% of any of the songs. It was all Uncle Cracker doing the singing.
Yeah, I remembered hearing, I remembered seeing like some MTV live performances and stuff of what he did, and Uncle Cracker was like 50% of his lines in like a 3-song set.
Yeah.
And he sounded so close to him that you almost couldn't tell the difference unless you were looking, unless you were watching and making sure Kid Rock was on the mic.
Yeah, it was awful. And even my wife came away disappointed. Just this is, you know, somebody that she expected to be a great performer and just awful enough that she, I mean, it's not like she threw out the CDs or anything, but he's definitely not something that is still in musical rotation at our house.
I can understand
Korn for
that.
Sure is.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, Korn definitely is. And in fact, I almost was considering my next pair of shoes being a pair of Adidas. That has something to do with a thing one of my kids did. That's an amusing story. We'll do that after the break.
Okay.
Yeah, Kid Rock was such a disappointment. And then, of course, Korn, we're already kind of reeling from the disappointment of Kid Rock. Korn comes on, and, I mean, Jonathan Davis beats the crap out of himself with a microphone stand, and it's just sublime. It's beautiful. It's not the band Sublime. Still the band Korn. Sublime couldn't have played then because dude was already dead. But, I mean, it was an amazing show by Korn. We were just like, oh, my gosh. My wife, this is like her second concert or something. And the concert before that, she had seen Perfect Circle and Nine Inch Nails. Little admission from me. Uh-huh. We arrived when Perfect Circle just started playing. I'm hearing Perfect Circle playing, and I hadn't heard anything by Perfect Circle at that point.
Oh, man.
They hadn't, the stuff hadn't hit the radio. So I'm listening to this. I had no idea who the band even was. And I'm there with our tall redheaded friend that I reference in that way all the time.
Yeah.
I didn't go there with him. I just happened to see him there at the show. And I'm listening to this, and I'm listening to this, and I look over at him, and he's laughing at me at one point. I'm like, what the hell? Why are you laughing at me? What's with the look on your face? I'm like, the voice is so goddamn familiar. I don't know who the hell it is, but I know this voice. What the hell is going on? And he's like, dude, it's Maynard. I'm like, you're fucking kidding me. That's Maynard? when the hell did he leave Tool? No, this is just a side thing that he's doing for the guitarist. The guitarist is the guy in charge of the band. He's just doing the side thing, singing with him. Like, oh my god, this is freaking awesome. And so at that point, Perfect Circle became part of my musical library because, hell yeah, if it's got Maynard in it, I'm all over that.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then we got to see Nine Inch Nails, which that was my wife's first real concert that she saw. She'd seen like a couple of country shows before, but I don't count those as concerts. Because seeing a show is different than seeing a concert. You know, you've played in shows.
Yeah.
Have you really played anything that you would call a concert per se, or just kind of shows?
I'm
not trying to be little in any way. I'm just
not at all.
To get a gauge.
If we're talking like a club show or club gig, I wouldn't fully consider that a concert. I'm of the personal, okay, so a concert would require a theater or something of the like a theater or a hall. And I have played a theater, technically speaking. Okay.
Then there you go. You got a concert.
I have also played festivals, and festivals are fun too. But
that counts too.
Club shows are like, they're definitely not the same thing. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a show. The other's a concert.
Yeah, for sure.
I guess I haven't been lucky enough to go to any of the concerts. I've just been to the club shows. Unless you count the school one you guys did as a concert. That's kind of somewhere in between. Oh, that was a badass show.
That was fun.
That was a good show.
Oh, that was a while back, man.
I had personal things going on at that time, but the show was still good. Again, that's all my wife had seen for a concert, really, was the Nine Inch Nails one. And Nine Inch Nails was a good concert, don't get me wrong. They're awesome. I'm big fan. But Korn was like, watching Korn, that was like epitome for her. She had just seen the best band she had ever seen on stage. I could see the look in her face, and I'm like, you're about to be proven wrong. right, coming up, right now, you're going to see the best band you've ever seen on stage. And then she did. And later she had to admit she loved Korn. She hated Kid Rock. Kid Rock looked even worse by comparison, especially because he had to come up during Metallica's set and do his stupid song. Or no, that song wasn't out yet. He did something with Metallica. He came out and he sang one song with Metallica. I don't remember, but anyway.
Oh my goodness, I think I know which one it is because I've heard the bootleg of it, and he was drunk. And yeah. Yep, okay, that was Detroit Rock City. He covered Detroit Rock City with Metallica. They covered Kiss.
He might have done that night.
James called out Kid Rock to sing, and Kid was gone. He was smashed out of his mind. I remember.
But anyway,
I've heard that bootleg. That's hilarious. You were there.
Yeah, but anyway. Maybe that was it that he did. But she seeing how good Korn did, seeing how good Metallica did, it was just like, nah, Kid Rock was complete and utter garbage. And mean, I had kind of the good fortune and the misfortune to have my first concert be a band that it takes a lot for other bands to live up to.
Right.
And luckily my second concert lived up to it, because I mean, my first one was U2. And whether you're a fan of U2 or not, those guys put on a damn good show.
Yeah, I was going to say, you could hate them for all they are, but they put everything they possibly can into their shows.
And their fans, oh my God. When you're, again, a lifelong
dreamer.
Oh,
their dream, fans are Aussie crazy.
For that one, I got to be on the field at the Oakland Coliseum.
Oh, cool.
And yeah, when you're standing in the, when you're standing on the field of a of any Coliseum, any stadium, anywhere, and the singer is just standing there with his arms stretched out wide, and all you can hear is the crowd singing in unison in key, and the singer's not doing anything, the rest of the band's not doing anything, the crowd is just doing it for 2 minutes straight.
Yep.
The same lines over and over again, and they're all in perfect sync, all in key together, and I didn't even know enough of the songs at that point, but I'm just standing there as a 16-year-old boy in awe going, this is like the closest I have ever felt to a religious experience. This is amazing.
Wow.
I could ascend now and be happy. And luckily, Metallica brought out about the same thing from me. Of course, with them, it was more of when the double kick starts up and the mortars start going in one. And it's vibrating like all of your clothing around you.
Right.
That's kind of that moment of like, oh yes, I understand what Trent was talking about. Trent Reznor was talking about being closer to God. This makes me feel that way too. But also butt sex might. But anyway. anyway, I
good night, everybody.
I was going to say the movie that our original topic of conversation that got us down this rabbit hole, the movie that I like Little Richard in, and we should talk about Little Richard a little bit.
Yeah,
we should talk about actually there's two movies I like him in, holy crap.
Well,
I just remembered another one where he's amazing, and then we should mention, of course, Jerry Stiller at some point.
Definitely.
But right now we are a little late for our break, so we'll take a break right now.
All right, that sounds good.
Little more about Little Richard, a little bit about Jerry Stiller, and a funny thing that happened with one of my children as part of our distance education.
And oh, okay.
The new PE requirements that we're trying to do at home to keep the kids active and moving instead of sitting on their asses playing with their tablets all day.
Oh, boy, this sounds fun.
Yeah. So we'll be back in just a minute.
Hey, friends, this is Mike from the Xennial Chronicles reminding you to subscribe to our YouTube channel. You can also follow us on Twitter and Facebook at Zenchron, spelled X-E-N-C-H-R-O-N, to keep up to date on all things TXC. And please check out our official website, thezennialchronicles.com, or if that's too much to type, zenchron.com. Thanks again for listening, and now, back to the show.
And we are back.
Woohoo!
We are freshly bearded. At least I'm freshly bearded. Did you get freshly bearded?
I have fresh whiskey.
Oh, you got the whiskey.
Yeah.
I started with beer, so I'm staying with beer.
I'm a mixed drink guy.
If I stay with the same alcohol, you know, through the whole night, then I don't have any chunda problems, and I don't like the chunda problems. Once I start mixing things, then I start getting the chunda problems.
Oh, that's not good. I can understand that completely.
No. Chunda bad.
Chunda bad.
Yes, chunda very bad. So we left you,
yeah,
listeners, with some promise to talk about Little Richard. Now, I'm not going to go into too much detail about Little Richard's life and history, other than to know the fact that you had people back in the day, like Elvis Presley, that were saying that Little Richard was the greatest. You have, I mean, the one nickname that we found of his that we thought was the most interesting was the Architect of Rock and Roll, because this is the guy that really helped to bring African-American music into the mainstream.
Oh yeah.
With a style that was just so new and so unique at the time. And he really helped to bring what we know as rock music into the fore.
Very
and
much so.
People like to cite like Bill Haley in the comments, Rock Around the Clock is like the first big real rock and roll song. I'm sorry. Somebody like Little Richard is much more of the innovator, especially considering the longevity and the popularity that his music still has, even to this day.
Yeah, the thing about him is, this guy, okay, so you've got Bill Haley in the comments, which is basically like, that was homogenized version of rock and roll in general. But the guys who you, the people that you look at that are the real big cats of rock and roll, like, you look at Elvis Presley, who was trying to just be a country artist, but look at the other guys. Jerry Lee Lewis, the Beatles are a huge rock and roll band. A lot of people argue that they may or may not be a boy band, but that's beside the point. These guys were straight up nuts when they were the Quarrymen and when they were working with their deal was leather jackets, fast rock and roll, and like staying out late and like doing quite a bit of drugs. Actually, you did not know what these guys were doing before they became mop top boy band material. Like, they just they were crazy.
It's not really surprising once you get to some of the later albums and all the drugs they were doing during those albums.
Well, definitely, but I'm talking about John Lennon being late to a show because he's busy getting laid backstage. That kind of stuff. But this is like, these guys are pulling off Def Leppard stuff before Def Leppard was like a twinkle in somebody's eye, you know?
Well, I mean, my question would be, after John Lennon got laid, did he punch the girl? Because he had a problem with that, too.
I don't think that was part of it. I mean,
Lennon actually had a real problem with being abusive to his first wife.
Yes, he actually did. There's evidence of that, actually.
Oh, yeah.
There's very much evidence.
That's what
of that.
I was referencing.
Yeah, but what I'm getting at is that these guys that got big on rock and roll, and I'm not talking like Bill Haley, I'm not talking like them, I'm talking like the big guys like Elvis and the Beatles and them. Little Richard wrote the playbook. This guy was the model that Jerry Lee Lewis was based on.
Yeah.
When you look at their performances in general, that's you could see it.
Yeah.
It's like insanely relevant.
You get Little Richard, I'd say Little Richard and Chuck Berry would be like the two that were kind of the model for all of
pretty much, yeah. Yeah. Little Richard, Chuck Berry, and then there were other guys too, you know, like Fats Domino and that kind of stuff, but
to some extent, but I mean, if you're talking about the stage presence, the performance,
exactly,
and then just kind of the
we're talking like the big personality, the larger than their body type people. Well, they filled a room with their presence, man.
That and the apparent kind of reckless nature of the music, when in fact it was actually really well done music, really well structured music, but it sounds and appears and feels and invokes a sense of recklessness to it.
Yeah, for
sure.
And
that's where that kind of comes from. If rock music is anything, it's controlled recklessness.
Yeah, it is the idea of I would consider it to be, and a lot of people should consider it to be this, when you look at rock and roll, the reason why it's appealing, it's that same hectic, it's hectic, it's fast, it invokes rebellion, it's punk music, it's heavy metal, it's death metal now, it's that stuff that invokes, like, it's the current day comparisons to rock and roll music is that.
Primal emotions.
It's primal emotions set to music. Exactly.
I have my own personal memories of Little Richard as a kid, obviously from the music, because my parents were very much into old school rock and roll music. Mm-hmm. I heard so much of that growing up as a kid. But one movie as a kid stands out in my mind, and one as an adult stand out in my mind. Now, the one as a kid, it was the second one I thought of. I don't know if you ever saw the movie. It had very, very young Doogie Howser era Neil Patrick Harris in it. It had Ned Beatty of much fame, but Deliverance fame specifically.
Okay.
And Shelley Winters, of all people.
Hmm.
It was a movie based off of a song. It was a movie called One-Eyed, One-Horned, Flying Purple People Eater. And literally the creature.
God, that's
from
taking
the song,
it way back. Nice.
The creature from the song finds itself, I think, Interestingly enough, it may be in a trailer park. I don't remember exactly what the setting is. But it finds itself in this small little community and befriends young Neil Patrick Harris. And if I remember correctly, it's been so long since I've seen this. There may be some government officials involved trying to, like, low-level government officials trying to capture this thing, trying to sell it. Some things going on. Little Richard somehow becomes involved to do some kind of a concert. And this creature, of course, can play music out of its horn. As is indicated in the song.
Of course.
And so Little Richard just has a small part in it doing performance, but it's great. Holy crap, I thought of another movie with Little Richard in it. I really like Little Richard as an actor.
Uh-huh.
So the next one that just popped into my brain is a movie that I still need to find a full copy of because I love it. I had you watch a scene from it not too long ago. Mother Goose Rock and Rhyme.
Oh, he's in that? Oh, of course he'd be in that.
He's Old King Cole.
Oh, my goodness. What a wonderful casting. That's a perfect casting call.
In fact, the scene that I showed you where the main character, Gordon Goose, is in the dungeon.
Yeah.
And there's a band playing in the dungeon. That's just after he's met Old King Cole, and Old King Cole throws him in the dungeon.
Oh, that's great. Throws him in the dungeon, and that's when Dweezil Zappa shows up and all that, right?
Yeah, there's some amazing casting in that movie.
That's fantastic.
Paul Simon's in the movie. ZZ Top. ZZ Top or 3 Men in a Tub?
Seriously, that's fantastic.
The casting in this movie is so amazing. It's one of those movies that it's disappeared from being able to really find copies of it to watch.
You're going to have to digitize an old VHS or something.
I so just want to get a copy of this movie just to be able to watch it over and over again. It's one of those so horribly bad, it's good. I think Gary Shandling and Terry Garr are Jack and Jill. I mean, again, the casting of this. The three blind mice are played by Bobby Brown and two of his dancers.
Nice. I think you've showed me the three blind mice part.
Yeah, they have an office above a club where there's literally these Stray Cats playing music, and it's literally the Stray Cats.
Of course it's the Stray Cats.
Brian Setzer's there.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, again, such great casting. Woody Harrelson, I believe, is in it. Debbie Harry is in it.
Wow.
I think it's Cyndi Lauper in it as well. Such amazingly great casting throughout the entire movie. But anyway, he's fantastic in that. But then the movie that I first thought of, the original one, the one more recent, my blockbuster movie. Do you remember the movie Mystery Alaska?
No, I remember hearing the title, but I don't remember like the film. I never watched it.
You probably watched the preview a whole bunch of times because it was one of those kind of blockbuster exclusive movies back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of my favorite movies, especially when you consider the cast in this movie. Okay.
Okay.
The lead in the movie is Russell Crowe. And this is before Gladiator had hit big, because this is a B movie. It's about a little town in Alaska that plays hockey on their frozen pond. And a guy who grew up in the town and left to go to live in New York City has decided as a PR stunt to bring the New York Rangers up to this little town and play hockey against the town's hockey team on their little pond.
I've heard of this. Would you call this a B-movie? Okay. I remember it had a theatrical release, didn't it?
I don't know if it even got a theatrical release. I think it may have been a straight-to-video. It might have been theatrical, but it was not like a big A-list movie, and there was no current A-list stars in it. But it had a cast list that was just kind of amazing when you really think about it. First of all, again, the main character is played by Russell Crowe. And this is, like I said, before Gladiator hit big, so before he was, like, the it guy.
Yeah.
And he's just playing, you know, small-town sheriff. Then you get Burt Reynolds as the town judge. Now, this is on the latter half of his career. He had done Boogie Nights. So
right.
He had kind of had a little resurgence with Boogie Nights.
Right.
And he had done one of my favorite roles he was ever in, Striptease with Demi Moore.
Right.
Do you remember him from Striptease?
Yeah.
I will never look at Vaseline the same way again. It squishes between my toes. The comedic turn that he took in that movie, he should have got an Oscar for that. Hank Azaria is the guy who lived in the town, went to New York, and brought the New York Rangers. Now, if anybody listening does not know who Hank Azaria is,
you probably shouldn't be listening to this podcast right now.
You probably shouldn't be allowed to listen to or watch any media, period. Let's just put it this way. If you've ever loved anything about The Simpsons, you love Hank Azaria.
Yep.
Because he does like 30 voices on The Simpsons.
Yep.
This guy is an amazing actor that does just wonderful things. Interestingly enough, he was in a movie, one of my favorite movies, with one of the other people we're going to talk about, Jerry Stiller's son, Ben, The Mystery Men. I love that movie. Anyway.
Oh, that's right. Oh, Hank in Mystery Men is fantastic.
He's
like my favorite character in that whole freaking movie.
He's a good character in that movie. I don't know. I kind of like Paul Reubens in that movie. Just cause, you know?
You know, there's honestly, I don't consider any of them to be particularly bad. One of my favorite, like, unlisted, unknown cameos in that film is CeeLo Green, though.
Oh, yeah. CeeLo Green, they're the not so goody mob.
Yeah.
actually, I think we discussed it before, but Michael Bay is actually in one of the bad guy gangs. He's in the group of frat boys.
I didn't know that.
Like director Michael Bay, like,
dude, just like yeah, for sure.
Flag floating in the thing.
Yeah,
and of course Eddie Izzard is amazing in his part. But
that's
not the movie we're talking about. We're talking about Mystery Alaska.
Okay.
Now, in Mystery Alaska. So Mary McCormick.
Okay.
That name maybe not as familiar. How about Colm Meaney?
Who?
If you're a Star Trek fan, you know who Colm Meaney is.
Off the top of my head, I don't know by the actor.
Let's see. Name. Chief Miles O'Brien from Deep Space Nine.
Oh, okay. Yes. I know him as Miles O'Brien. I just didn't know his name.
I knew you would. Lolita Davidovich.
I know that name.
Okay. How about Ron Eldard?
Nope.
He was in a decent amount of things. Kevin Durand.
Nope.
He's kind of a bit. He's an Australian actor that Russell Crowe brought into this movie. He's been in a bunch of different movies with other Australian actors. Most notably known for playing in Wolverine Origins. He plays the Blob.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. Let's see. Scott Grimes. He's a fellow redhead like you. He's been in a lot of different things. Gosh, he's one of those guys that just kind of moves through different movies. He's on the Orville. You've seen the Orville, right?
Oh, yes.
He's the redhead that's one of the
Navigators. Okay. Oh, dude.
Yeah. You've seen him in a lot of stuff.
Yes.
And let's see. Who else is? Adam Beach is in it. Pretty famous Native American actor. Michael McKean has a small part. He gets shot.
Nice. He gets shot.
Michael McKean of course, Spinal Tap fame. Yes, he gets shot in the foot.
That's not good.
It's part of the story. He deserves it. He's kind of an ass.
Oh, okay.
But it's a fun kind of feel good, not quite family, but almost family movie. But Little Richard's part in it, he's brought in to sing the national anthem to start this hockey game.
I was going
to
say, well, Little Richard, who we're talking about.
Little Richard.
Okay.
Brought in to sing the national anthem to start this hockey game. Well, the problem becomes instead of it being just this open pond where the town is used to playing hockey, they end up creating it to make it an actual like hockey rink, like professional.
Right.
So it kind of gives the New York Rangers the advantage of this small town team has never played with boards before. They've never played with, you know, any of this kind of stuff. So the only advantage that Russell Crowe's character can think of is the fact that they're used to playing inside of a building that while the ice is frozen, the building is not freezing. Whereas this is going to be outside.
Right.
So he goes into Little Richard and like, hey, can you do a little something with the national anthem? And of course he's on Little Richard's bus kind of talking to him about maybe something he could do with the national anthem. And Little Richard is literally under five blankets. He's himself. He plays himself. He's under five blankets and just looking at him like, what the hell do you want me to do? So he comes out, and of course he's in this like gigantic purple fur robe.
Of course.
And he sings the national anthem, the American national anthem, obviously, because it's in Alaska. And he takes forever with it. He sings like a super long version. You don't hear the whole thing, but
right.
You can tell he's taken forever with it. And then as the New York Rangers are like, all right, we're ready to go and whatnot, he starts singing the Canadian national anthem. And the Rangers are just like, what the hell? And it's this little tiny bit part, but like that little bit of a part, he plays it up so well.
That's great.
And it's just one of those fun little cameos. I love it when celebrities come in and play themselves, and it's really, really fun when they do.
Yeah.
You know, they have fun with it. This is just, he was just having fun with it, and it was great. Great little tidbit. And when I think of Little Richard, that's the moment I think of nowadays. Just because it's a fun little tidbit with him.
That's fantastic, man.
But on to the other celebrity death, since that seems to be the things we're focusing on this time around. Jerry Stiller was kind of, I honestly, he's not somebody that I think regularly would enter my mind as like, this is somebody that's a treasure. But at the same time, like, he's freaking hilarious.
That earned an iconic status in a lot of those post-2000s movies. Well beyond his validity as a younger comedian in his career.
Oh, yeah.
That's what I noticed more than anything.
Yeah, as an older comedian, he's been fantastic.
Yeah.
And again, somebody who knows how to play, he knows how to play over the top with nuance, if that makes any sense at all.
Yes.
It sounds
just
like
the right amount of it too.
Yeah, just the right amount. And some of the stuff, he's a guy that can do so much with such a little bit of a part. He has a very small part in, I'll admit it, I am a musicals junkie. I love watching musicals, especially movie musicals. And I am a fan of Hairspray, the original, by the way,
yeah.
And the remake.
Okay.
I will admit I'm jealous of both Divine and John Travolta for playing an amazing part. And if you don't know what part that is, first, if you don't know what part that is, go watch yourself some Hairspray. It's amazing. Second, if you don't know who Divine is, stop listening to us. Or go find out who Divine is.
Yeah.
Because that's important. Or moreover, who Divine was.
Yes.
Say it that way. Some respect. But anyway, don't watch Pink Flamingos, though. That's a weird movie. But anyway.
Is that one of those John Waters films?
Yeah, it's a John Waters one. I think that's the one where Divine does bad things with stuff that... No, I don't want to say anymore. anyway, he plays...
I've seen it once and not again.
I've seen it once and not again either.
Oh, no. No, why?
What? Yeah, no.
Yeah.
Why? Anyway, moving. second Hairspray, the John Travolta Hairspray. Jerry Stiller was the owner of a boutique for plus-size women, and is Mr. Pinkies. And he has just a little bit of a part in there. And he just, again, does so much with this little part, able to get so much out of it. And amazing. And then again, you got to consider the fact that he did father a comedic genius for our generation, for sure.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Ben Stiller.
Not only that, but he showed the dude the ropes. Are you kidding me?
Oh, yeah.
Like, he was...
He got him involved
any
in
parts
so
that
many
he
things.
Got, yeah. He put him in everything he could, and it was worth every... I remembered watching Ben Stiller movies, waiting for Jerry Stiller to show up somewhere.
Point. I believe he was a big proponent of the... didn't Ben Stiller have a show on one of the major networks at one point, one of the pay networks at one point, like an HBO or Showtime or something? It was the Ben Stiller show, and it was like a sketch comedy show for a short time. It was one of those that had a bunch of like major comedians work on the show, then ended up becoming like big comedy people at some point or another in their life.
Yeah, him and Dana Carvey did the same thing, too.
Yeah, and I think Jerry Stiller was a big part of that show happening too.
Yeah, and he had already earned his stripes at that point, man. He had been a known comedian at least for quite some time.
Yeah. So I mean, it's funny because we've discussed it before, but it's funny how sometimes the loss of a celebrity can sometimes mean, I wouldn't say mean more, but touch us in different ways than even what loss of people that we know does. I mean, I'm not saying we don't feel it and aren't hurt by the loss of that person.
Yeah.
But like the way that celebrity culture works, we let them into our lives a little more. We take almost a little bit of ownership of their personas and their characters. I think mainly their characters. For me, at least, it's their characters. It's an ownership of the characters. I mean, I can say having completed finally the watching of episodes 1 through 9 of the Star Wars movies for May the 4th.
Yeah.
Last week. It hits even harder now watching the scenes with Carrie Fisher in them.
Oh yeah.
Especially in episode 9, watching the last scenes that they have,
yeah,
her that they had to cobble together from leftover footage from episode 7, because she was already passed away before the movie even started filming.
Yeah.
And just to watch it in the way they do a good job of giving her honor at, you know, with it, but those are hard to watch now knowing that you know. And I only really connect her with the Star Wars movies, but she was an amazing human being in her own right and just a character and a half in reality.
Yeah.
But just to lose that from, you know, the loss of the character is a bit of a heady thing. By the way, watching them all again in order gave me a appropriate perspective on it, as did I'm segueing a little here into some Star Wars talk, as did a interview I saw recently with guy by the name of Dave Filoni. Do you know who that is?
No, I don't.
Now, in Star Wars circles, Dave Filoni is like, how do I describe it properly? Moses or something, I guess.
Whoa, okay.
Or,
whoa.
For anybody who might be listening, that's a Muslim. He's like the Prophet Muhammad. He's like for Star Wars geeks, he's literally the right hand of God. If George Lucas is still God in some way, shape, or form, Dave Filoni is the right hand. Because
okay.
George Lucas has basically told Dave Filoni everything about Star Wars. Everything that George knows, Dave knows. Dave Filoni was responsible for the majority of the Clone Wars and the TV show Rebels.
Okay, so this guy really knows what's going on.
Yeah, he knows everything. And he gave some insight as to Qui-Gon Jinn's role in the original episode 1, and the fact that Qui-Gon was supposed to basically kind of end up being a father figure for Anakin, and would have helped Anakin be able to stay kind of on the light side of the Force. And the music that plays during Qui-Gon's fight with Darth Maul, the Duel of the Fates.
Duel of Fates, yeah.
It's literally about the fate of Anakin and the fact that Qui-Gon dies. That seals Anakin's fate to be eventually taken over to the dark side, because Qui-Gon saw more of the cosmic and living Force than what the other Jedi did. He was kind of a rogue as far as the Jedi Council was concerned.
Yeah.
And that he did not get involved in the politics. He was the one that would find the, you know, weird life forms and kind of connect to them. Obi-Wan didn't want to deal with Jar Jar. Obi-Wan didn't want to deal with Anakin. He didn't see the importance of the uninformed, unintelligent life forms. He was already in that kind of Jedi mode of not wanting to act like they're better than everybody else, but actually acting like they were better than everybody else. And Qui-Gon could see kind of the necessity of these things, kind of see that there was worth to everything. There was importance to everything. And because of Qui-Gon's death, Anakin doesn't get a father figure. Instead, he gets somebody that treats him and raises him like a brother, but never a father figure.
Oh, wow.
Something that Anakin is constantly searching for and never gets to have. And it's in that moment in Return of the Jedi when Anakin realizes that he has to, you know, he's looking for that in Palpatine. He's looking for a father figure, and Palpatine ends up giving him kind of a father figure. But in Return of the Jedi, he gets the moment to see that he has to step up and be the father for his kid, something that his kid didn't get because he wasn't there,
right,
and that Anakin never truly got. And that's when he betrays the Emperor and tosses the Emperor down the thing.
Is, right.
Not really killing him, but still attempting to in the whole concept of finally being the father that he never got to have, that he always wanted to have.
Man.
So it gives it so much more depth when you really think about it that way. And it's like, shit, okay, that's what George was thinking about. If he had done a couple lines of dialogue, we would have got it. George maybe was working on a deeper level than what we all thought.
Very possible, because I remember people just started calling him crazy when those prequel films came out, man.
But watching it now all together, the nine stories, they do make a lot of sense. And even Last Jedi doesn't, as much as people have been decrying that recently as having strayed too much from things, and even Mark Hamill, he had some choice words to say about the direction they took Luke's character. It makes perfect sense. Luke becomes this big hero and everybody expects everything of him, and then he fails. And the thing is, he doesn't know how he does the same thing that Yoda did. He does the same thing that Obi-Wan did, go into hiding. And the realization was, crap, I made a mistake. I was dumb. I let fear take over me. And if you really watch it with that, it makes sense, man. Look, you're 25 years old and you become the hero and save the galaxy and you're going to start all this over again. And suddenly you make the wrong decisions and it all falls apart. Everything's always worked for you. Suddenly it falls apart. What else would most people do? They'd go crawl in a hole somewhere.
Yeah.
And then suddenly have the epiphany, you know, it may take somebody else to finally have the epiphany of, oh crap, you know what? They were, you know, you were expecting a hero and I can't be that hero because I screwed it up. Well, then let me go try to kind of be that hero in a way.
Yeah.
And like the journeys make perfect sense. It's actually really coherent and cogent. So it was a lot of fun to watch it again that way.
That's
and
fantastic.
To see it all that way, it kind of stuck on me. Now, this little weird segue, but this makes me think of my fatherly things that I've been having to do recently.
Okay.
You know, the stuff I've had to do as a father with my kids and kind of the sharing of traditions and of you know, what things we love. Like my oldest son did watch some of the movies with me. So that was nice because he's a Star Wars fan just like I am.
Right on.
And so it's great to be able to watch the movies with him. But recently we've been having a little fun with my daughter.
Uh-huh.
They're doing all the distance learning stuff. And one of the things that her teacher likes to do with her is after they've done all their classwork and stuff, they'll pick a song to watch a YouTube video of while they're doing the computer sharing and whatnot. They'll pick a song to watch a video of. Usually it's just a lyric only video, so it doesn't have the actual video stuff.
Right.
But they'll kind of just sing and dance the song. It's kind of the reward for getting all the work done and, you know, trying to keep. It's just something that my daughter likes to do, and it's good to do with the teachers, right?
Yeah.
And so we were trying to come up with different songs to regularly listen to, but she picked one day that I had never heard the title for, teacher had never heard the title for, and it was, I think the title had something to do with the word work, but it was a fairly scandalous song once it started playing about the work involved the female seeing it grinding on top of a guy's body.
And what?
Yeah. Needless to say, it didn't use any foul language. It was something that was played on the radio, but it was,
of course it was, metaphorical and all that. Yeah.
But it was on the edge of the scandalous. And for the teacher to be listening to the song with one of the kids, it's a little bit like, all right. And so when it was done, I was like, okay, that was an interesting song. Teacher was mildly embarrassed. And I'm like, well, you know, here's what I have to say about that. When I was my kid's age, one of the songs that I liked listening to the most, just on my CD player and whatnot, on the radio if it came on. I didn't really like it on the radio because you got the edited version on the radio.
Right.
So one of my favorite songs I liked listening to at that age was the song Adidas by Korn.
Right.
And so the teacher started laughing because the teacher's young enough to know what that song is.
Of course.
One of the other educators that was on the session, the Zoom session, just kind of gave a quizzical look. And I said, yeah, you should go ahead and check that song out. Just don't do it around your kids. That's a song for your ears only. If you don't know what that one is,
right?
Because that's what I listened to at that age. So I really can't say much about what my kids listened to. And so, again, anybody listening, if you have not heard the song Adidas by Korn, listen to the unedited version, please. Not around kids, though. Or if you're going to do it around kids, make sure, well, kids don't play outside anymore. I was going to say, make sure it's like when they're playing at a park and you just drive by in your car with the windows rolled down, blasting as loud as possible.
I mean, so I have a question for you. Is there a possible way to segue this to another, to our original, I mean, not to a celebrity death in general, but maybe to one of our original subjects. Have you ever looked up the original lyrics to Tutti Frutti? Good night, everybody. we encourage you to Google that.
Yes. Yes. That was a really dirty song. I mean, if you think Adidas was dirty in any way, shape, or form,
oh man,
no.
No way, dude. No, yeah. They couldn't. They couldn't, but yeah, he would that was the song, man. That's what it was.
Yeah, definitely. Here's your project, listeners. Google the original lyrics to Tutti Frutti.
Yep.
Because, damn.
You talk about writing the playbook on Scandalous, man. I tell you what.
Before he was performing as Little Richard, he was performing in drag. You know that, right?
Oh, that's great. No, yeah, I didn't. But you know what? Great, dude. That's great. I knew that he was
very progressive in so many different ways.
Yes, I knew he was progressive. He was somebody who definitely at the time was, it was not well known to most of the public, but he was definitely someone who was of an alternative lifestyle. And that is not, I do not say that in any, you know, in any judgment period at all. Like, you, well, I am down for anybody being who they are as long as you're not hurting anybody else. You know what? If you can live life to the fullest that way, go about it. You know what I mean?
And I think you use the appropriate terminology in the sense of saying an alternative lifestyle. There was, as much as we try to put labels and names on people's gender identity, sexual preference, all of these things that we want to have labels for, we want to have little boxes to put people in. There was never really a box that these labeling people want to make that he really fit in, and that's why alternative lifestyle would be the best combination of words to describe it.
Yeah, he was his own
person. Let me rephrase. Little Richard was their own person, because I'm not even sure. I would sure with the name Little Richard, I'm sure he identified in some way male, because he never seemed to say otherwise. But
well, definitely, he didn't. Yeah, I think he was.
But definitely a unique and non-conforming individual, somebody that was going to live their life the way that they lived it with minimal labels. And
oh, this guy, yeah, he wrote, if I may say, he pretty much wrote like he wrote the playbook for people like, you know, David Bowie. You know what I mean? Somebody who embraced the ambiguity of their character and just wore it straight. And they were larger than life.
Now, that's a funny choice of words.
And,
seeing as he was found with Mick Jagger once, I mean, you know that, right?
Oh, yeah, I know. I know, but...
Now, whether anything happened between him and Mick Jagger when they were naked in bed is a whole different story.
That's funny. Dude,
wasn't it Marianne Faithful who found them that way?
I don't know.
Might have been.
I don't know that story. But what I'm getting at is that Little Richard was one of those people that taught. He taught a lot of rock stars what the rock and roll lifestyle was, and he was someone who was. It was very strange because he was both spiritual and religious, while at the same time being very, very lifestyle positive.
Yeah.
I would say would be the best term, I guess. And there's a lot to learn from somebody like that, where you can be proud of who you are while still being, you can be proud of who you are. And if who you are is larger than life, then, you know, do it and don't let anybody else tell you otherwise. Don't let anybody repress you like that. That's the biggest takeaway from him. I think that anybody could really, really, that anybody could really get.
I can see that. Plus, dude made some awesome music.
His music was incredible. And it still is. Oh, yeah. Still is.
Yes.
I'll probably be jamming it as soon as we're done here, man. And I tell anybody else who's you know, anybody else who's listening to do the same.
Please do, yes.
You might learn
yes,
you something about good music, man.
Wasn't it, weren't they listening to that on the Walkman I can't think of the movie now. Fern Gully. Isn't that what's on Zag's Walkman and Fern Gully?
No.
Doesn't he have some Little Richard on there?
No, that's not Little Richard. That's, No, that's, oh, man. Oh, I can't, I know the melody of the song, but I don't think that's Little Richard.
Hold on, I'm finding out.
Yeah, I can't remember the song that's in the, it. I know that was a remake, but you're nope, talking about that gospel sounding one, right?
Yeah, I'm not seeing it.
It's like gospel rock.
No, it's not gospel.
Hold on, I'll look up the Fern Gully soundtrack. Or I won't, because apparently I don't have freaking internet access right now.
I'm looking at it right now, and it's not giving me anything.
Well, my interwebs aren't working, so I got nothing, man, and I'm using the phone to get you. So
that's all right. Anyway, watch Fern Gully. It's like Avatar, but better.
Avatar the Musical.
It's like Dances with Wolves, but with Will Scarlet instead of Robin Hood. That's a fun reference. I remember when my son asked me one day to watch the Fern Gully with the blue people. So proud of him. so proud of him. But anyway, I think that's what we have for the week. As rambling and weird as that all was.
Yeah, I don't know exactly what to... we had... I don't know. This is kind of outside of technical Xennial purview, but you know what? I'm quite satisfied
We've discussed celebrity deaths before. And again, Jerry Stiller gave us a amazing comedy of his own, and then his son.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Little Richard laid the blueprint for rock and roll stars that we know and love today.
Absolutely.
I mean, this fits within the Xennial Chronicles stories.
I think you might be onto something.
Just because it didn't necessarily happen during that specific time doesn't mean it didn't. It kind of adds some kind of color and flavor to our experience.
Kind of hits a Kellogg's vibe a little bit, but slightly less negative.
Yes. Yes. The cornflakes didn't help. They didn't help at all. Trust me.
Nope.
I ate boxes. It didn't make a difference. Is that how they came up with Frosted Flakes? Just curious. Anyway, moving on.
Oh. Good night, everybody.
Yes. You seem to like saying that today.
You keep saying stuff that makes me say it.
Good. At least, hey.
How deep into that next beer are you, man?
Not very. I'm still sober. Anyway, Mike. Where can people listen to this? I mean, it's funny that we do this at the end because like people are already listening to us, but still. Where can they listen to us?
You can listen to us at thezenchronicles.com or zenchron.com, spelled X-E-N-C-H-R-O-N. Speaking of Zenchron, you could follow us at Facebook and at Twitter at Zenchron, spelled the same way. And you can also listen to us on many different podcasting websites. We are on Google. We are on TuneIn. We are on Apple. We are on... I always Spotify. Forget the fourth one. Spotify, thank you. I always forget Spotify. and
we still love you, Spotify.
Thank you. Just shout out, not an endorsement, but yes. We are not endorsed by Spotify. But you can also catch us on YouTube as well, which we're also not endorsed by. We're not endorsed by anybody. Why is that?
Speaking of YouTube, I got a question for you.
Yeah, what's up?
So remember we had a message from Tombot, right?
Tombot, yeah.
Well, we have a message from a Ted. Is Ted another bot?
Ted is what does Ted say? What is his what was his comment?
Ted commented, "Wanna be friends."
Yeah, that's a new bot. Yeah,
that's another bot.
Yeah, I got
screw
a couple,
you, Ted bot.
I got a couple of those on
be
my
your
new
friend, Ted bot.
on my video that I put out, I got a couple of those too.
Which video was that you put out?
The newest one, the cover of Super Bon Bon.
I know the song.
Yeah,
I just don't remember when and where from, but I know the song.
Did you hear it? And did you hear the original and go, "Oh yeah, that one"? And you can't remember where it's from?
No, I heard your version. I watched your version of it.
Oh, okay.
And then I'm like, I know that song. I just don't remember where I know that song from. Probably my teenage years, but I don't remember. But I know
that
song.
Yeah, it was one of those more obscure ones that I remembered hearing, and I absolutely loved every time I heard it. I was like, oh, man, I love this song. And I looked up Soul Calfing afterwards, and they've been fantastic. They broke up some years ago, and their main guy, Mike Dowdy, continued to do stuff for quite some time. But, that was a hell of a one. If you guys want to hear that one, sorry for that strange segue into a pitch. I also run a YouTube page called Ruling Note Music, and I did a cover of Super Bon Bon, a metal version, on my video. So, yeah, check that out, too.
Very funny, reminiscent of another guy that I've seen on YouTube that does a lot of covers and does some similar stuff, but I applaud your video, sir. It was very well done. The music was very well done.
Thank you.
And hey, I lofted that softball up for you to smack out of the park, man. Celebrate the things that you do. Even if it's not this, we need to still celebrate it and get people to be paying attention to it.
Thank you, man. Much appreciated.
Cross-pollination is good.
Right,
we
on,
cross-pollination, we wouldn't have lemons, dude.
Right.
Yeah. So
I'm growing a lemon tree in my backyard, too.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
I really don't care.
And on that note,
thank you all for listening, and we will be back again next week.
Y'all have a good one.
Thank you for tuning in, friends. The journey continues next week.